No, I appreciate your coming in. This is probably the height of the publicity season for you.
This is the start.
This is the start.
It started really at the Today Show about an hour ago.
How'd that go?
A good 4 minutes.
I'm always, I was talking, John Updike came in. He had done the CBS Morning News, and Diane Sawyer had interviewed him, and he came right over from the broadcast center to do an interview with me. It was on the occasion of The Witches of Eastwick. Mm-hmm. Remember that book?
Sure.
And so I asked him, how did it go? And he said, it was terrible. He stutters a little bit. He said, it was terrible. Diane Sawyer, she asked me, what do women want from men?
Oh.
And he said, I couldn't think of anything to say. I stumbled out with something like, I think they want the same thing men want. But he said it was the dumbest question, and it just put him off. So he was never quite sure with television people. Or radio.
No, in radio, at least you have a chance to phone her. I mean, radio is built on
Well, the last time we met, you probably don't remember because you were in the height of the excitement of the Penn International Congress. And it was such an exciting period. You held news conferences, and I remember Gunter Grass strolling up to the podium with his pipe.
Oh, yeah.
I remember how you handled Erica Jong. She walked up, grabbed the microphone. I think she said something like, we don't want to be ignored. We women don't want to be ignored. And you said something like, Erica, I don't think anyone can ignore you. A lot of people didn't think you were going to be able to pull that off, but you really did, didn't you?
I had a lot of help. And Penn is a pretty efficient organization, considering that, you know, we never paid much, and people who are doing it really are in that work because they want to be. Usually such organizations like that usually don't work too well, but Penn did, and a lot of bright people, and so it wasn't that hard.
Yeah, I guess the executive. Yeah, well, we're taping, so I take the tape and I edit it into finally jewel-like broadcast.
We're going to talk for an hour.
Yeah, we'll just
Take how much out of that?
I'll use it. Peter can tell you how I'm going to set it up, but I'm going to do a five-part series.
I know that. In other words, if we talk for an hour, how much of that will be on the air?
It depends. I have to listen to it. You don't have to worry about it. I'll do all the editing. So.
In other words, it could be 30 minutes, it could be 50 minutes.
Yeah, you can be as, if the question is how verbose can I be, don't worry about that.
Okay.
We'll just chat. I mean, I prefer not to do it in the presence of microphones, in fact, if they could be hidden, because I wish we could be on an airplane talking. It would be almost the same thing. But I was going to say the Penn, of course, has an executive director who probably does most of the administrative work, whereas the president has kind of an inspirational job.
Well, I had to do fundraising. That was the toughest part of it. Fundraising is not easy. There's a reason why there are so few fundraisers. I mean, for all I know, there may not be any greater number of good fundraisers than there are good novelists. It's because the qualities you need are contradictory. And I started doing it, and I discovered it was very tough. You have to flatter a great many people that you don't necessarily like all that much. And in other words, you convert your personality into a working mechanism that tells itself intrinsically that the end justifies the means, and you turn yourself inside out. So I get very angry sometimes when in any organization there'll be people who are always criticizing, and almost without exception, they're the ones who don't raise the money. And I remember getting furious at someone who'll be nameless, and turning to her and saying, damn it, I spent a half year raising money, and I lost half my ass doing it. So don't stand there and say, you can't do it.
Have you been following the latest controversy involving the Steinbergs? They've been kind of written out of the Penn as contributors?
Well, I think they withdrew. I mean, it was a hopeless situation for them, because every time their name would have appeared with Penn, the old charges would have been brought back. So, in effect, Penn lost their finest and most generous contributor. But that's Penn. Anyway, I'm more interested in Actors Studio right now.
Oh,
because we're doing a jubilee next year. where we'll be doing something like the Penn Celebration. We're going to have a number of plays put on by novelists. We're going to have eight occasions, eight nights, with plays we put on by novelists, and we're going to sell a subscription series.
What is your role in the Actors Studio?
I've been a member of the Playwright Directors Unit for years, and my fear is that in the course of the next few months, I'll become again one of their leading fundraisers, which is a tough... I'm going back to that job that I'm half good at and don't like particularly at all.
Any chance one of your plays might
Of course.
Which one?
You know, you can only do something if you're not only your best motive, but your worst motive is involved. So Strawhead, a play about Marilyn Monroe, I'm going to bring it back. We did it once at the studio 5 years ago for 11 performances, and we'll do it again. Same cast.
I think it's very interesting to note that in the 1940s you wrote a play that I don't believe was ever produced. It was about a mental illness, and the title of the play was The Naked and the Dead.
You know, you're one of the very few people who know that. Oh, yeah. And then later it was turned into a novel, and it was called A Transit to Narcissus. Good title, I think. This is before, yes, it was before Streetcar Named Desire. So, same rhythm. But
That's a novel that has escaped me. When was that published?
It was never published until it was put out in manuscript form, published in manuscript form as a special book by Howard Fertig, a good many years ago, 10 years ago maybe. But it was written in 1943.
That was the year you graduated from Harvard, I believe.
Yeah. And in the year following my graduation from Harvard, I wrote that book, waiting to go to the Army.
Help yourself with the water, if you would like.
Yeah. Hey, could I have some coffee?
Peter, would you mind getting some coffee?
No, just going out for it?
No, going up. Go up to the 20th floor here. Let me give you a treat.
Oh, I have money.
No, that's here. Protect it. Can you break 100?
For a coffee machine?
I've got some dollars.
No, here. Upstairs, what do you need in the coffee?
Black. Made a mistake of eating breakfast just before I came over.
Get up a little closer to the mic.
Yeah. So. Let me push this here and I'll lean forward.
Sure.
That should do better.
The coffee request made me lose my train of thought.
We were talking about Transit to Narcissus, the play about a mental hospital.
Yeah. Well, of course, you had worked. Didn't you work in a mental hospital?
I worked there for a week. And thereby established a pattern for life to when I worked in a place for a week and spent a year writing a book about it. And I've done that several times since. I was in Palm Springs for 20 minutes many years ago and then wrote a novel about it called The Deer Park with an imaginary town called Desert Door.
You are able to quickly assimilate the environment, I would assume.
I don't know what I'm doing. Let's take the first choice.
Well, in Harlot's Ghost, I'm up to the point where Harry has arrived in the Soviet Union, and you have a wonderful description of Harry and his waterlogged passport to the surly guards. The description of the taxi driver going into Moscow, the description of the doorman at the hotel. The sleaziness of the hotel, the room, the barren room, the rather untasty dinner that Harry has in the hotel dining room. These are wonderful, wonderful details that you have. And I know that you have been to the Soviet Union, but you haven't spent all that much time there.
No, I spent a total of about 3 weeks in the Soviet Union. I made three visits there, twice in 1984. Once in 1986. And what was, I remember the first time I came back in March of, by then it was April of 1984, I was angrier than an American I've ever been. I came back, my feeling was, how dare we talk about that place as the evil empire? It's a poor third world country. They're not our antagonists. They don't have the capacity to fight us. Now, mind you, I don't have too much respect for people who go to a country and come back and in 1 week they can tell you all about that country. But in Russia, it was so palpable. You know, it was like going up to the equivalent in a way to going to one of the worst streets in the barrio or in Harlem and coming out afterward and saying, people here are not leading very happy, balanced, peaceful lives. Now, it doesn't take any great acumen to see that. You can feel it in the absolute, the palpability of the mood. And the same thing was true in the Soviet Union. I've never been in a place where so many people were so profoundly depressed and where the shoddiness of everyday existence was so evident everywhere. You know, they couldn't make soap, they couldn't make towels. I thought, if they can't do this, then they cannot really have a true fighting machine. Their technology can't be too good either, because technology finally comes out of the culture that supports it. And if you have a culture that is not capable of making decent products at a low level, they're certainly not going to be able to make decent products at a high level, because you don't have all the intermediate steps. So now the evidence is going to come out that, for instance, they have three times as many tanks as we did because they needed them, because they didn't have people who could do maintenance on the tanks, and they couldn't design tanks that didn't keep breaking down. So as a result, they needed three tanks because they cannibalized a tank as soon as it broke. And in that way, they could keep one tank in action by having two tanks sitting there as a sort of movable supply of parts. It's so forth. You take it through the missiles and everything. At any rate, when I came back, I was just furious. I just thought, this is the biggest scam that's ever been pulled off on the American public, which is that this country is our deep and profound enemy. It's just a depressed, demoralized country that is going nowhere.
Well, I'm a product of the 1950s, and I was absolutely convinced that the communists were going to take us over. They were like gangsters. We were told this. J. Edgar Hoover told us that. It was an advertising, a propaganda campaign that put Madison Avenue to shame. And we look back at it now. I remember I was talking to Howard Fast, who's maintained all through the years that these peace conferences that the Soviets and their allies spearheaded were actually peace conferences. But we looked upon these peace conferences as pure communist propaganda, efforts to take us over, to subvert our democracy, and this sort of thing. Now, looking back, we have a new perspective of history now. It seems, you said scam. I think it was a con job.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because there were a great many things here that needed it. But for one thing, it was very, very good for our economy for a period, although I think when historians look back on it 50 years from now, they'll say that in the course of destroying the Soviet Union's economy, because that was where the real war was going on, which economy wrecks the other. And we put them on a forced march, economically speaking. It was like taking a heart patient and making them run up and down hills. So they had to push their economy into military technology and keep equal with us, not just for a short period, but for decades. And that wrecked the rest of their economy because they were so badly constituted as a functioning economy anyway. But in the course of ruining theirs, we did our own a great deal of damage, because all our best engineers went into the military-industrial complex, and we didn't have guys who could design good toasters and good washing machines anymore. And so our products began to grow inferior to the Germans and the Japanese. And we've ended up in an inferior relation to them, economically speaking, that may go on for decades or may never be recovered. This may be the end of the American economic empire. So that it was a stupid war, I think. Totally, I think, you know, so long as Stalin was alive, there was an element, I'd be willing to agree there was an element of mania in the communist mind. There was this idea, especially after winning the war, that maybe they could win the entire world. But I think by the time Stalin died, that was already pretty much on the back burner. And I think the historians will decide over the next 50 years that everything the Russians did, everything the Soviets did over the last 30 years was a rear guard action. They were fighting to hold us off, to keep us from defeating them. And finally we did. But it was a shameful, scandalous, wasteful business. We didn't need to do it that way. We could have made peace with them.
Was this the impulse that led to the Harlot's Ghost?
Well, at the time, I think probably it was the impulse that led to it, but I wouldn't say it was the governing force that went through it, because as I was writing the book, it was obvious the Cold War was coming to an end. And so I became interested. There was no, by the time I was done, there was no propagandistic impetus to the book. I had no message I wanted to give the American reader. What I wanted is I wanted to say to people who would see the book, this organization has, I don't know about you, but it's obsessed me all my life. What is the CIA like? Who are they? What are they really like? And so I want to give you as objective a portrait of it as I can arrive at, taking account of all the prejudices I started with. So, the working guide I kept all through it was that when the book is done and people read it, I want half the people to say they want to abolish the goddamn thing, and the other half to say I'd like to join them. Then I know I've written a book that truly captured something about the CIA.
But certainly a timely book in light of the Gates hearings of the past 3 weeks. And at those hearings and calls for the abolishment of the CIA is just being unnecessary.
Well, I don't think, oddly enough, I think they now have more of a real purpose, because they were, for all these years, they've been the arm of the right arm of an ideological war. And their sole function was to keep that Cold War going. There's an awful lot in the book about how certain kinds of evidence was always being covered up whenever the signs were pointing too directly to the fact that the Russians had smaller military capacity than we had been saying they had. There'd be cover-ups of that fact one way or another, and there's a great deal of intricacy in a great many intricate moments in the novel that involve just how we would cover that up.
Well, it's been said that a novel is something that you can write anywhere. You can go to the beach and write it. You can write it on an airplane. You can do it in a spare room. And I don't believe that's true, because in reading Harlot's Ghost and looking at your author's note in the back and all of the research material that you did, that's stuff you can't carry along with you on the beach.
No. It's not a good idea to start writing a book anywhere at all. I find that there's certain places I can write and others I can't. You're terribly sensitive to your surroundings. You can finally, if you have to, write anywhere. But it's better if you have a place that you go to every day that you're used to, because so much of writing is a conditioned reflex. I mean, after all, don't forget, you're always, every day when you wake up and you're working on a novel, and generally when I'm working on a novel, I work every day for quite a period. I may work 6 days a week for weeks, months. I feel in the morning when I wake up, I groan. I think, oh God, I gotta get that Cadillac started again. And in my mind, getting started, commencing to write on a given day is always equal to taking a Cadillac and pushing it uphill. You know, you're just gonna get that Cadillac moving. It's so heavy before it's starting writing. So when you've got that, when you feel that you're living under that particular burden, it helps. Every conditioned reflex helps. So if you go into a room where you've been writing for years, the room reinforces that confidence for that morning that you're going to be able to write one more time, because you've gone in that room for 1,000 mornings in a bad mood, saying, I've got to push that Cadillac up the hill. And let's say on 900 or 950 of those mornings, you've succeeded in doing it. And so that helps. Whereas if I suddenly went to someone's patio and started writing, it wouldn't work at all. I wouldn't have all those little hints that, yes, you can do it.
No, in Harlot's Ghost, there are three major characters, Hugh Montague, Kittredge, and Harry. But there are dozens and dozens and dozens of other characters, both fictional and real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would seem to me to keep track, well, the real characters have to come out of history, and this is the research that you had to do. This would indicate to me that you must have had a pile of research material at your hand to refer to as you began to write.
Well, for certain parts of the book, obviously much more than for others, but I did a great deal of research on this. Oh, yes. That's one of the reasons it took 7 years. I mean, I hate research because it slows me up terribly. It's much better if you can imagine something out of whole cloth and just do it. And not have to do research, but a book like this just demanded that. And after all, I didn't mind, because there are virtues in it too. Writing about the CIA is, I love the, I love the theme, I love the material. A lot of the reading was interesting.
E. Howard Hunt, did you ever talk to E. Howard Hunt?
No. I never talked to Marilyn Monroe or Gary Gilmore or a lot of people.
As you point out in the book, Howard Hunt is also a writer and had written a number of espionage thrillers. And I had interviewed him, and in fact, I drove him to the train station the last time I talked to him. He was a very engaging guy. But he turned out to be a relatively major character in the book. Tell me about the process of integrating the real and the imaginary in a novel.
Well, I to tell the truth, to the degree you see it as a process, you're in trouble. Once you put these characters into your book, we get into that, we get into something that's hard to describe, but my characters have to be real to me or I'm miserable. In other words, if I'm not thinking about them all the time as real people, then I'm at a loss. For instance, there's a woman in this book called Kittredge, Gardner Montague, who was considered a genius by people in the CIA, Alan Dulles for one, because she's come up with a new theory of psychology that could explain spies. So it's eminently useful. This is in the early 50s. And I was talking about her theories once. Excuse me.
Help yourself to some water.
So I was talking about her theories once to somebody, and I went on and on. I got on a riff after a while and was truly expatiating on her work. And when I finished, the person said, "My God, you're talking about that woman as if she's real." And I sort of came up short, and I realized, yes, I'm thinking of her as real as anyone I know. And so, as I say, once fictional characters have to become real, it's very hard to write a book if they're not. Because as real people, they then become very interesting to you. What are they going to do to each other? What are their relations? How they shift? And so forth. The actual characters, the real ones who are in history, so to speak, are often more difficult as a result because it's harder to have them seem as real. Now, Howard Hunt in this book became very real to me. Whether it's the real Howard Hunt or not, I have no idea, and I would guess it probably isn't. I'm sure he deviates from the real Howard Hunt in any number of ways. But I did have certain guides. In other words, when I put a real character into a book, I don't want them to be completely my creation, have nothing to do with the original. On the other hand, I'm aware of the fact that unless I know them very well, I'm not going to come close to them. And even if I did know them very well, I found through experience that when you write about real people, they're almost always dissatisfied with the portrait. I know I am. When people write about me, I'm usually not very happy because I'll say, well, whatever it isn't me. So knowing that, when I do these characters, it's just important they become real to my concept of them. In other words, that I have a, not a concept, it's the wrong word, that I have a notion of them, the way I would have a notion of you, sir, or anyone else that I know. In other words, I would have an idea of what the person's like. We do this all the time. We meet someone, we have an idea of what they're like, and then as they speak, we realize that idea is not quite right. They're a little different than that.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that the imaginary character that you build from scratch is someone that you really get inside of. The real character, you can't do that. They're off in the distance, and they have their own character, and unless you distort them in some way, they're not really yours.
No. Well, you have to be very careful not to distort them. On the one hand, you're never going to be on the nose. You're never going to get them accurately if you don't know them. And even if you do know them, you're not going to get them accurately. But you can stay within certain bounds. In Hunt's case, he'd written a couple of books that I was able to use that gave me a particularly clear idea of what he might be like. And it was that idea of what he might be like that I used to when I was able to use him as a character. At a certain point, I felt, well, I've gone into such detail with him, maybe I ought to give him another name and call him, whatever, Charlie Stunt Sloan or something like that. And I thought that would be unfair to him. And I talk about this in the afterword. Because then people will read it and they'll say, well, see, that isn't really Charlie Stunt Sloan, that's Howard Hunt. And the moment people say that, then they're absolutely convinced that that is exactly the man and there's no deviation from it. Whereas if you use his name, people say, well, I don't think that's Howard Hunt, that's not my idea of him. So in a certain sense, you're protecting someone by using their real name.
The High Holies. Tell me about the High Holies.
Well, that's for the next volume.
Well, they're
introduced in this book, but
they're well
we don't come back to it.
They're well represented here in Harlotsville.
Yes, but what you'll never get any more about them than you have in the first 100 pages. That's saved for the second book. You know, people have come up to me and saying, well, you don't finish this book. In effect, how dare you? And then I remind them that Margaret Mitchell didn't finish Gone with the Wind. The biggest single question in Gone with the Wind is, does Scarlett get Rhett Butler back? And in fact, we don't know it on the last page. On the last page, it's really to be continued.
Unfortunately, it was.
I didn't read the...
But in a way, books, I guess, are like life. Books show what happens to a group of people at a given time and place. That's the way our lives are, too. I mean, our lives never really quite finish until the end. And even at the end, they're not finished because there are reverberations.
Well, exactly. But that was what I wanted to get in Harlot's Ghost. You see, when I was writing the Executioner song, I learned an awful lot about the way things happen, because something like 300 people were interviewed for that book. And I kept being frustrated. As a novelist, I was frustrated constantly by the fact that very often two characters that I had become most interested in, when they met, did not have a terribly interesting meeting. It was disappointing. One's expectations were usually left short. And then I also realized that there was a secondary phenomenon, which is these frustrations would build up and build up, and then, unexpectedly, there'd be a major confrontation that would just blow up, and enormous things would happen. And I realized that's what life is like. We spend our days going through scenarios that never have a denouement. We're expecting this or this to happen, doesn't happen. We're expecting that to happen, doesn't happen. We keep building up these plots for ourselves of possibilities, and then after we just about given up, after 49 plots did not take place, the 50th erupts, and we're engaged in something that's larger than ourselves. And discovering this process in the course of putting all these interviews together and seeing what happened and what didn't happen, at a given moment I just threw down my pencil and said to myself, God's a better novelist than the novelist. So I wanted to get something of that quality into Harlot's Ghost, which is that there are any number of things in this book that do not happen, and a few that happen that are most explosive. But I felt that will make it lifelike, that the characters are not wholly finished, that they're three-quarters finished, nine-tenths finished, one-tenth finished, whatever. The certain people we know very, very well, the people we know superficially. The key thing in our lives is to keep increasing the knowledge we have of life. That's what we do every day of our lives, is we try to add to our fund of knowledge. And it's an imperfect process. And the way we learn things is always various. New ideas, new information comes to us from a variety of sources. And in a certain sense, this novel is what I would call an epistemological novel, which is a study in how we learn things and the degree to which we learn. One of the things CIA people often do is when they're giving a report on the likelihood of something, they give a percentage to it. They say, in effect, I think this is 80% possible, 30% possible. Whenever a piece of information comes in, it's evaluated that way.
Yeah, you say life is grabbing bits of knowledge. Life is also...
And assimilating them.
And assimilating. But also I find that life is waiting. We wait to receive and assimilate this knowledge. For example, I waited the weekend for you. I'm going to wait another week and a half for Jimmy Breslin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to wait another 3 days to go see the eye doctor. I'm going to wait 7 more days before I go to a memorial service for some relatives who are being buried and reburied, reinterred. So it's waiting. It's waiting. So there are high spots and in the middle, this flat period where you wait for these events to happen. Don't you find that to be the case?
Oh, absolutely. But, of course, you can't quite do that in a novel. It'd be tempting to do it. Beckett did it, in effect. Samuel Beckett has passages of prose that are nothing but waiting. In fact, he erected an aesthetic out of that principle. But for us lesser, those of us who are not quite so venturesome, we tend to telescope events a bit in order to not to have all those waiting periods.
Yeah.
But it's a principle you have to bring into good fiction, I think, which is that not everything happens neatly and quickly. Every book that has a very good plot has it at the expense of the characters. You see, at a given moment in the novel, I don't care how good it is, one or the other has to suffer. Either you relinquish the plot because the characters take on their own life and the system going their own way, or you keep cutting the ankles off your characters or stretching their legs in order to make them fit the plot, which is why there's a certain level of good fiction that can never rise above being good because it's subservient to a plot. Makes for a nice, easy read, but at the end of it, you've got very little. It's equivalent to going to a play where you laugh all night and then you walk out and the play's over and says, you know, it was a silly play.
Yeah, the approach that you took to writing Harlot's Ghost, I remember several years ago when you wrote The American Dream, you did that kind of like Dickens did his stuff in installments. I think you had 6 or 7 installments published in Esquire.
Yeah, 8 maybe. I think it was 8.
That sounds to me like not a very good way to do a book because you can't go back. I mean, for example, you could write yourself into a hole and in the first chapter you wish you hadn't done what you've done. But with Harlot's Ghost, of course, you had complete control from beginning to end.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about this process of writing and executing these words.
You mean this book or mm-hmm. American Dream?
Well, no, Harlot's Ghost. I know how you did it with American Dream.
I didn't have a closed ending. I don't like starting. I don't like writing a book when I know what the ending is going to be. Because, again, I want my characters to take over the book. So that I'm following behind the characters where I'm, not to sound mystical, but I don't mean it that way. I do think that there's a part of the brain that prepares one's novels that won't let, that's our own internal CIA. It won't let the rest of the mind in on what it's up to. Because I found that it's very dangerous for me to know what I'm going to do in a book. Because once I do know, I get so excited that I tend to tell people about it. Or in celebration, I'll go out and get drunk or whatever. And then I won't show up for work the next day.
You don't do that anymore.
No, not anymore. I've gotten terribly disciplined over the years. But when I was younger, I used to waste a great many possibilities in books by getting, by being too enthusiastic and by sharing, if you will, my book with myself. Now it's gotten to the point where it's as if someone else is writing the book and doesn't tell me much about it. And what I have to do is show up for work each morning, and then slowly the unconscious begins to present what it has to offer, and it comes out. And I'll be able to, each day I can advance my book another 1,000 or 2,000 words or 500 words or whatever it is for the day, and the process continues. But if I don't show up for work, the unconscious has prepared it. The unconscious is separate from myself. And so there you've got all those troops waiting around in the rain, mm-hmm. trying to express themselves that day, going to battle that day, so to speak, and they can't because the general is sleeping off a hangover. Is this clear what I'm saying?
Yeah, it is, and it sounds to me, now this sounds like it may sound to you like a contradiction, but it seems to me that a man who has been as undisciplined as you, you are certainly a disciplined man. I mean, to be able to sit down there and to put these words on paper, and not just words, I mean, these are words that interrelate, characters that develop. This is an enormous, not only an enormous creative task, but a task of discipline, because nobody stands behind you with a gun saying, Norman, write this book.
Well, that's the one tough thing about writing. You know, you can't beat the hours, and you certainly can't fault the freedom. You can write anywhere you wish to write. You can live anywhere you wish to write. But then if you can make a living out of writing, then you really are a free man in the social sense. But the one difficulty is that you are your own boss, and you have to show up for work. And so you can't baby yourself. You have to become a professional, and it is a demand. Since, I mean, if you're an athlete and you're a professional, you've got a coach, you've got fans, you've got public exposure, you've got the risk of immediate humiliation. These are all powerful motivating factors to stay in shape. But when you're a writer, you know, you get your reward or your comeuppance every 2 or 3 years, or 4 or 5, or in this case, every 7 years. And so you have to stay in control of yourself. And, you know, it gets easier as you get older. I mean, the one virtue I think in getting older is I find it's easier to do a lot of things than it was when I was younger. But the key thing always, when young writers ask me for advice, the only advice I ever give them is that if you tell yourself you're going to work tomorrow, then you show up no matter what mood you're in. Even if you're totally hungover and you're sick and you don't want to write, sit at that desk as a penance for 3 or 4 hours. But you've got to form the habit that the unconscious, which is preparing the work, knows that there will be some opportunity to get it out the next morning. Because I think we prepare things in our sleep. You know, parenthetically, one of my arguments with journalism has always been that they, all too many stories are obliged to be written on the same day they take place, and the reporter doesn't have an opportunity to sleep on it. So the story has a superficiality to it that's built in, because you have to sleep on things in order to deepen them.
Well, that's certainly an advantage that you've had with regard to your journalism, because you've been able to sleep on your journalism.
Exactly. I've been able to sleep for 7 years, pushing my story forward. But anyway, you started to ask me about what happens when, you know, how does the book get written? Since the emphasis is on the characters, if the book takes turns I wasn't expecting, I follow them. I didn't start this book with the idea it was going to be a 1,300-page book. I thought it might be a 300-page book when I began it. And then as it went on, I found I was more and more interested in the characters and what was going on. I was more and more interested in the very phenomenon of the CIA, that I wanted finally to try to write a novel about the CIA and what it would be like to a young and reasonably decent, sensitive young man growing up in it. And so this book, which started as a spy story, became a Bildungsroman. In other words, it's the story of a young man's education as he gets older, a moral education, a spiritual education, a practical education, all of that. And he, and in the course of this book, he becomes more and more of a man. And of course, becoming more and more of a man, he also becomes somewhat more corrupt, which is a story for a great many of us. It's a universal story. All youths have to become men. They don't have to become men, but it's their aim. It's the aim of most youths to try to become men. And of course, in doing that, they not only become stronger, but they also become coarser, cheaper, meaner, and less noble than they were when they started. And I thought that, well, that's a fine structure for a long novel.
You revealed a few minutes ago on this very broadcast that the High Holies will be explored more deeply when the book continues. Now, are you absolutely so immersed in these characters that you want to take it even further?
Oh, yeah.
You're not tired at all of this?
Well, you're always tired. I mean, I can't think of a day in the last 20 years where I haven't felt tired. But and I hesitate to say I'm going definitely to produce the second book because, well, first of all, I think this book stands by itself. You know, our lives are all unfinished. But we certainly wouldn't say that our lives can't stand as a record of who we are and what we've done. So in that sense, the second book does not have to be written, but I want to write it. However, writing a novel is not an automatic act of will. And I'm talking about all the discipline of going in day after day after day. You can do that only if you've fallen in love with your subject. I can do a book of nonfiction without being enamored of what I'm doing. It's a professional task, and I can fulfill it most times. But when it comes to a novel, the novel almost has to come to you. There are certain ideas that you almost have to get before you can begin a novel. There's a certain stirring in the breast that's analogous to love. And then you can start to write a novel. I wouldn't dream of saying, I guarantee to deliver this novel in a year or 18 months or whatever, because it doesn't work that way. The novel has to come alive or it's no good. And when it comes alive, it's willful. It takes its own route. It gets longer or it stops short completely like a recalcitrant animal, a beast that just simply won't stir for 3 months. So you have all sorts of problems when you're writing a novel. But it's my intent and my hope that there'll be a second volume.
Now, you've won two Pulitzer Prizes for your nonfiction, but I have... The problem with journalistic writing, even that published in books, is that it can date. But with a novel, novels can be dated, but there's something about fiction, that good fiction, that can be read for centuries. So I just wonder if the fiction gives you more fulfillment, personal fulfillment, than the journalism.
Oh, it does. There's just no question of it. You know, a lot of people think that the Executioner's Song is my best book. And I don't argue with that, but I don't take the same pleasure in The Executioner's Song that I do in other books of mine because that was a gift. That book was handed to me. Providence wrote that story. And then I was able, in a fortunate position, being able to come along and receive all these artifacts from Providence and put them together into a book. And I wrote The Executioner's Song not with, dare I say it, my talent, but with my skills. I've been a professional writer for, at that point, something like 30 years, 35 years, and it was just a matter of using what I knew in order to put the book together. Now, I'll say a certain amount of a little more went to it than that. Perhaps it wasn't that routine. But I didn't feel as if it were entirely my own. You see, I felt as if I shared that book with the events that had given it to me. Whereas with Ancient Evenings or with this book, I feel it's mine. And so there's more of a sense of achievement in it.
On a more crass note, I noticed that the price of The Naked and the Dead was $4, and the price of a copy of Harlot's Ghost is $30.
Mm-hmm. That's the cost of the Cold War.
That's staggering when you think about the amount.
That's how we wasted the economy all these years. That's why we've had this huge inflation.
And you know, The Naked and the Dead is not a short book.
No, but you know, The Naked and the Dead broke the price barrier also.
Is that right?
Yeah, it used to be $3 for a novel. And I remember Stanley Reinhardt saying, we're going to charge $4 for this novel, and heaven help us if we can't sell the copies. But I don't feel bad about the $30. I mean, my Lord, I figured out it's something like 2.5 cents a page, which is far better, if you prorate it, it's far better than the average novel you spend $20 for that's 300 pages long. I mean, 1,300 pages for $3, for $30?
That's the argument James Clavell uses. He says, buy my book, you know, like getting three books in one. It saves, there's not as much shelf space taken up. And
there's at least three novels. I think there are four novels in one in this one. Let me top Clavell.
Looking back at The Naked and the Dead, that's a book that, in spite of the problems with the language and everything, still holds up pretty well. In your mind, do you think that's the case?
Oh, I'd like to think it's true. I really haven't reread that book in 30 years.
That must be a strange feeling to say, here I was a kid in my 20s when I wrote that book. It's almost like someone else wrote it. No,
it's my book. I still feel close to the kid who wrote that book. I mean, that book taught me an awful lot, which is you don't really have to know everything about a subject in order to write a novel. You just have to dare to write the novel. And then you transcend yourself. Transcendence can become your closest friend. it's what goes on with athletes all the time. Any athlete who ever reaches a high level, you know, any athlete who becomes a world-class athlete did it by having something like 200 or 500 or 1,000 acts of transcendence in his or her life. As they get better on a given day, they're just far better than they've ever been before. And then, if they're really a wonderful athlete, 6 days later, they do it again. And so on. And they just keep rising. So you can do the same thing in writing. You just have to have this, I think there's a vocation for writing, and I think you have to have it in powerful quantities. But once you have it, you're willing to dare certain subjects that you wouldn't otherwise go near. You can by just applying your energy, your intelligence, your will, and whatever talent you have to something, and giving it a whole commitment to it, you can do a lot more than would seem evident.
It would seem to me, though, that writing The Naked and the Dead ultimately was a terrible burden because you were faced with trying to top it.
Well, that was tough for a number of years, sure. And because, after all, I didn't know that much when I wrote the book. All I knew was the Army. And I didn't know it that well. I mean, you know, Jim Jones knew the Army far better than I did. So once that book was written, I had nothing to write about. The only thing I had to write about after that was my childhood. And I've never, for some reason, whether good or bad, I've never felt like writing about my childhood, which was a perfectly ordinary and, you know, not at all a miserable childhood. I just felt maybe it wasn't exciting enough to write about. I don't know. But at any rate, there was nothing to write about. And so I went through a number of years before I began to have enough personal experience to be able to feel I could write again. And I had to go wandering, looking around for books.
Well, outside of the essays, like advertisements for myself and so forth, you really have stayed away from autobiographical writing, haven't you, at least in terms of your fiction?
Yeah. Yeah. I've always felt that it's risky to engage autobiographical themes in writing, because I think every time something happens to you that's that has a quality of intensity to the experience, it forms a crystal in your psyche. And you can, for years afterward, you can project a light through that crystal in one or another direction and have a book. It's what they speak of when they talk about themes. A novelist's themes. I think of them not as themes, but crystals. You keep a certain, it was Hemingway used to talk about it, but don't talk about it. But certain experiences should be kept intact and never revealed. Because to the degree that you don't reveal them and don't write about them, you can use them. You can get 10 stories where here there's just one in the crystal. The crystal has but the one tail. But as I say, putting the light through it from different angles gives you 10 tails. And so when you do an autobiography, you're likely to smash all your crystals.
Hmm. You know, listeners of this broadcast would probably be surprised to learn that you have a Bachelor of Science degree in aeronautical engineering.
Yes. And, I used to build model airplanes when I was a kid, and my dream was to be an aeronautical engineer. And I was going to go to MIT, but I grew up in Brooklyn, actually in Crown Heights, which is now always in the newspapers for riots. In my day, it was sort of a quiet, relatively, wasn't poor, but sort of lower middle class Jewish neighborhood. Very quiet. We used to play, it was so quiet that we could play touch football on the streets, and roller hockey in the streets, and occasionally a car would go by, and we'd jeer at the cars that went by because it was interrupting our game. But it was quiet, and, oh, I just lost the train.
We were talking about your aspiration as a young man.
So I used to build model airplanes.
Yeah.
Take them out to Canarsie to fly them. I used to build gas model airplanes. Wasn't very good at. But all the girls on the block, when it came time to go to college, they'd say, "Where'd you apply, Norman?" And I say, "Well, I applied to MIT," and their faces go blank. And I say, "I applied to Harvard." And then they'd light up and show a new interest in me. So my interest in airplanes gave way to my interest in girls, and I said, "Well, the hell with this. I'm going to go to Harvard." And I did. And I studied aeronautical engineering there, but in a most cursory fashion, because I think I lost interest in it about the time I realized that girls didn't react well to the idea that you'd be an aeronautical engineer.
Well, if you had it to do over again, would you have become an aeronautical engineer?
I think not. I think it would have been a miserable life for me. Think of being the third flunky on the way down in a big corporation, and you're working on the drag coefficient of an aileron or something like that, and in with all the political infighting so that your aileron gets accepted rather than somebody else's. I don't think it would have been a good idea.
You're a man with a high degree of creative impulse that probably the strictures of engineering and the mathematical formulas would not be too practical for you.
But I was good at math.
You were good at it, but I understand that. But the creative impulse sometimes in math don't always go together. You know what I'm saying? There are formulas that one deals with, that accountants deal with. I don't know how many accountants, for example, become novelists. It just doesn't seem to me they have that kind of...
Well, in a way, the only regret I ever feel about it is that maybe if I become an aeronautical engineer, I might have developed an extraordinary amount of experience in corporate life, engineering life, design life. And then at the age of 40 or 45 or 50, I might have become a most special kind of novelist. And everyone would have said, "Oh, Norman Mailer's novels about how airplanes are built and about the infighting on the design of a new fighter plane are absolutely extraordinary."
Well, maybe, but it seems to me that creative writing is such a long apprenticeship. Although you started fast. I mean, you really came out slugging, but for many writers, it seems to me it's a long process to learn it.
The apprenticeship goes on forever. You never finish that, but I think really the key problem in being a writer for many years is not the apprenticeship. And you can start fast and learn afterward. It's finding a way to keep going. It's tricky. You have to develop secondary skills or tertiary skills. Because on the one hand, if you want to be a writer, you've got to be sensitive to your environment. But if you're sensitive to your environment, that does not set you up very well to receive harsh and particularly unfair criticism. Yeah, I mean, it's bad enough when you read a bad review that's accurate, and there's a great deal to say about the weaknesses of your book. But that at least is surgical. It can clean out your psyche, and you may not make the same mistake again. But so much of book reviewing is unfair, petulant, serving the reviewer's needs, not yours, so that when you get sensitive people, they go half crazy with their early books. I've known any number of young novelists who never wrote a second book because they never got through the reviews of the first one. You know, particularly if they were at all pugnacious or violent, and most creative people do have several crazy streaks in them. I know one guy who used to be a professional prize fighter, a young guy, who finally had a book. He also was very talented, and he wrote a very good book. And then his book got slaughtered by Anatole Boyard in the New York Times. And I spent many an evening in the following year convincing him that he should not. He heard that Anatole Boyard was staying. This was a guy who was up in Provincetown at the tip of Cape Cod, and he had heard that Anatole Boyard was hanging out in Newport. I don't know how or where or when, but that was what he'd heard. He was going to drive down to Newport and kill Anatole Boyard. And I spent many an evening talking him out of it.
I think for you particularly, with early success, you become kind of a marked man anyway by critics.
Well, it's good and bad. You have all the satisfaction of being the center of attention, and you pay all the price for being the hole in the target.
But, of course, a good heavy dose of criticism never seemed to bother Michener. He never seemed to read it, and his readers didn't matter what anybody said about any of his later work.
Well, if you meet him and talk to him, and as I'm sure you have,
I have.
In my mind, he is the archetype of the inner-directed man. In other words, it hardly matters what's going on around him. That man develops everything out of himself and proceeds on that basis. He's like a ship with a built-in compass, and he almost doesn't have to pay attention to the weather. Unsinkable hull, so forth. But he's the exception. Most writers, but he's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. He's made me write book after book after book. But writers who are sensitive and take tough criticism or unfair criticism very often can't get through it, or they get crippled by it. Or they get defensive or scared, or they overreact and they get too pugnacious or whatever. It's the main difficulty in being a writer is to keep going.
There's another, just one last question, too, because we're really out of time. There's Jewish themes. You come from a Jewish background, but those themes have never been exploited in your work in the way that Malamud used them or Bello.
I was going to write a novel about the Russian ghetto and about people coming over from the ghetto to America, and I was going to write my Jewish novel. And about that time, I ran into the work of Isaac Bashevis Singer, and that ended it. I thought there's no sense in writing about this because I'll never be the hat on Isaac Bashevis' head. I won't even be the when on the back of his hand. I'll be nothing next to Singer. He's a great writer, and he knows so much more about Jewish life than I ever will that I gave up the idea. If I ever write anything about Jews, it'll be about my own life.
I hate these Jewish generational novels. Well, they start in a ghetto in Russia. They immigrate to New York. They work in the garment district, and it winds up that the young ones go to a kibbutz in Israel, and fight in the Six-Day War. I mean, it's the same story over and over again. So just as well you don't write a generational Jewish novel.
No, but I'll confess, I like tried-and-true themes that are worn out. I love coming along and seeing if I can refurbish them. I've written a lot of books, if I go back over them, that take what's a used-up tradition, and I try to bring some new life to it.
Well, now tell me a little bit. Just on the last question, you're a man in your late 60s. You probably have another 10, 14 years of productivity ahead before you get tired and the mind begins to slip a little bit. I say the mind goes first, but I've realized the mind doesn't go first. It's the asshole that goes first. But you have that ahead of you. That there's still a lengthy period of creativity and. Are you going to take a hiatus now and rest, or what? What's going
to
happen?
I can't afford to rest. I got 9 children, and that's my blessing. Amia Kazan at Actor Studio said one day, he was talking about work, and they always talk about the process at Actor Studio, the work process. He was talking about work and how important it was, and finally he looked up, and it came to him as an epiphany. He looked at us, and he glared at us, and he said, "Work is a blessing." And I thought, well, that man's usually right, and he sure is right today. And I've used that. It's one of those things. A couple of remarks you keep going, you keep with you through your life. Gary Gilmore had a great remark, a marvelous antidote to self-pity. He said once, "Well, nobody ever said it had to be fair." And I find that's enormously useful. I'm starting to feel sorry for myself, and I'll say, "Well, nobody ever said it had to be fair." And then you move on, of course. So you got a rough shake on this one, and maybe you'll get more than you deserve on the next one. You keep going. And the other one is work is a blessing. It's a most useful remark.
But I have a feeling that 9 kids aside, and the economics aside too, you're the kind of guy you've done almost everything. Whether it's gotten yourself into the boxing ring, or you've made movies. Or, I mean, you're the kind of guy who has to always do something, it would seem to me.
Well, I was. I had the great good fortune to have a mother who had enormous energy. And she worked hard. She used to work hard all day long. You know, my father was a marvelous guy in his way, very charming. But he was a gambler. And so my mother ended up earning the living, essentially earning the living for the family. She used to go out and work all day in a small fuel oil company that she ran by herself with all the worries of it. She'd come home at night, and there'd be calls from irate customers. She'd have to handle that, too. In between, she cooked meals for us. And she kept up her good spirits through most of her life. She'd have her down periods, but generally speaking, she was a warm-hearted, not quite happy woman because there were too many frustrations in her life, and she was working too hard. But she had a positive spirit, and she had this enormous energy. And so I think, well, if I have half my mother's energy, I'll do okay.
I think you'll do okay. Well, Norman Mailer, we about 15 minutes overdue, and I'm sure you want to escape this ordeal, or maybe you didn't find it an ordeal.
No, just at the beginning.
we're just getting started. We'll put on another tape, and we'll just keep going. Harlot's Ghost, what I've read, I'm up at the point where Harry is in the Soviet Union, and it flows beautifully, it reads beautifully. I hope this is going to be a real big success for you. It seems to be, from what I've read, a wonderful book. Norman Mailer, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Dan. Sorry.